Welcome to Yarns at Yinhu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 302, poems 1 through 10 of the 100-day project in poetry. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate, and each time I record an episode, I post photographs, show notes, and links to things I talk about on my website, yarnsatyinhu.com. This is a special episode. It is brought to you by Ko-Fi subscribers. Thank you so much for your generous support. You have provided me with the means and also the motivation to do some special episodes. I've embarked on a 100-day project beginning on Black Friday, which was November 26th, and continuing until March 5th. I will be reading a poem every day. I will be maintaining a list of these poems on my website, and every 10 days or so, I plan to do an episode that is a poetry reading of the poems that I've selected. Some I select and some I just sort of pull a few books off the shelf in the dark in the morning, stack them up, and then pull one from the shelf and find a poem. The great thing about this project, well, one of the great things, is that I never just read one poem in a collection. I'm always paging through and reading the introduction sometimes and reading a whole bunch of poems and then kind of settling on one that I read and maybe reread. And sometimes I take these books to school or take them with me and I might share a poem with someone else. In this episode, I'm going to share poems 2 through 10 because I shared poem 1 in episode 301. It's Trophic Cascade by Camille Dungy. Poem 2 is from a collection titled What Have You Lost? Poems selected by Naomi Shihab Nye. Naomi Shihab Nye is my favorite poet. She is a well-recognized poet in her own right, but she's also a very highly regarded anthologist. And What You Have Lost is an anthology. It's a collection of poems. Some of them are by well-recognized writers, and others are by regular people from around the world. A few are in translation, and they all respond to this prompt of What Have You Lost? I'll share a poem titled Kind by Leonard Nathan. I hadn't noticed till a death took me outside and left me there, that grass lifts so quietly to catch everything we drop, and we drop everything. Next is Shakespeare as a Waiter by poet B.J. Ward. This is from his collection called Landing in New Jersey with Soft Hands. B.J. Ward is a local poet. I've seen and heard him read locally many, many times. He's well-loved and respected, and this early collection contains a lot of reflection on his own inclination toward writing. And in this poem, he envisions Shakespeare waiting tables. He was tired of the old ladies wanting cappuccino, of the little kids with their chocolate milk or two cherries on a plastic dagger, anything to consume his time while he had more important things to do. A fair lady in booth 3 was dying for a Reuben, and 12 lit professors wanted another round of ale and song in the lounge, and his entire tip, probably depended on it. This is where he started to learn timing, when to allow the waiting, when to deliver what will last a while. His boss started yelling, "Shakespeare, bus your tables." He was tired of this too. He was tired of picking up and wiping down, tired of people's half-eaten burgers, tired of salad dressing, tired of the spit, tired of the cooks who called him Willie, tired of directing people to the bathroom when he had so much more direction to offer. But he didn't reject this, none of it. Instead, he took it in, studied it until he understood it. In his mind, things grew large. First nothing, then nothing became an ocean dotted with islands. Each island had a name: Venice, Love, Denmark. A dark count started to form, witches sang, stars crossed, and Shakespeare, between the napkins and the ketchup, lit a table's candle and waited for the evening shift. The next poem is Moon Hymn by Alice Oswald. It's from her Woods Etc. collection. Alice Oswald is a British poet. She has quite a few collections of poetry, and she is known for poetry on ecology and the outdoors. She also has a book called Dart. I love Woods and Dart because of their slim appearance and also their small size. This is Moon Hymn. I will give you one glimpse, a glimpse of the moon's grievance, whose appearance is all pox and points that look like frost glints. I will wave my hand to her in her first quarter, when the whole world is against her, shadowy exposure of her center. Oh, the moon loves to wander. I will go clockwise and stare when she is huge, when she is half elsewhere, half naked in struggle with the air, and growing rounder and rounder, a pert peering creature. I love her sidling and awkward when she's not quite circular. Oh, criminal, an ingrown, skinned animal, O moon, carrying inside yourself your own death's head, your dark one. Why do you chop yourself away piece by piece to that final trace of an outline of ice on a cupful of space? The next poem is by Ted Kooser. I adore Ted Kooser. He spoke at a National Council of Teachers of English conference I went to quite a few years ago now, maybe 15 years ago. He read and talked about poetry and teaching poetry. And at the end of his presentation, he said, if there are any women in the audience who would enjoy receiving a Valentine, I have a mailing list and I write a short poem in advance of each Valentine's Day, and then I have it printed and mailed out on a postcard. So if that's something you would like to receive, come on up and sign up for the mailing list. And then every woman in the audience waited in line to say hello and sign up for this mailing list. And I don't know if he's still doing it or I've just dropped from the mailing list, but for 3 or 4 years, I received a beautiful printed postcard from Ted Kooser with a poem on it. He has such a solid vision and sort of like a Midwesterner's grounded approach to things, but also a charm and a sense of humor. When I read his work, it always reminds me of Paula Emmons Feasley. And I think maybe it's partly that sort of Midwestern spirit that's at work there. I'm going to read Etude. It's the opening poem of his collection, Weather Central. I have been watching a great blue heron fish in the cattails, easing ahead with the stealth of a lover composing a letter, the hungry words looping and blue as they coil and uncoil, as they kiss and sting. Let's say that he holds down an everyday job in an office. His blue suit blends in. Long days swim beneath the glass top of his desk, each one alike. On the lip of each morning, a bubble trembles. No one has seen him there writing a letter to a woman he loves. His pencil is poised in the air like the beak of a bird. He would spear the whole world if he could, toss it and swallow it live. Next is a poem by Molly Peacock. I really enjoy a book by Molly Peacock about reading poetry and starting a poetry circle. And that was my first introduction to her and her work. And then I purchased this book, Original Love. It contains a lot of very intimate and sexual poetry. The one I'm going to read is a bit more of an Ars Poetica, I think. I think in this poem, Molly Peacock is sort of addressing her stance toward poetry and observation. I'm not sure, though. I don't have a lot of experience with this poem, so maybe it's one to keep rereading. It's called Life Study. Take a blank page and from the bottom draw a line to the midpoint. Now you have depth. This is perspective. The line is distance. In life, that line is healing. It causes terror to abrade. Why won't my memory try to draw three-dimensional pain on a tablet's page? Because healing moves memory into day. Fully lighted, kindnesses appear to repay some of the abuse. Now faces are appealing and complex, their angles jumping into relief. Now real rain enlivens vistas from the depths of hopes deserted at too young an age. Trauma redistributes its colors. Old drama quelled to tables laid for meals now actually eaten. You could say I've whitewashed my youth, since light from the end of the tunnel washes back through. As I draw, I see not what I stumbled through, but each illuminated sight. The next poem is from Michael Chitwood's The Weave Room. It is a fascinating collection that takes as its subject the lives of workers in a mill. And what Chitwood does with his poetry is he takes this very basic, very pedestrian, monotonous work, difficult work, grittiness, and he elevates these workers and their experience to, like, it's like an opera or a symphony. It's a wonderful collection. I fall in love with it again every time I read it. And for people interested in the fiber arts, I think it's particularly rich in literary allusions to cloth and fabric and other sorts of textile references, like this one, which is titled, Mrs. P, who worked in the cloth room, became famous for her quilts. Her day's work was inspecting the cloth, the men and women, and her night's work was undoing all the things she witnessed in the day, those busy mill hands being the devil's workshop. She stitched her fiery sermons against greed, lust, envy, drinking strong drink into the seams of quilts. Tiny letters of thread sewed brimstone into lone star, double wedding ring, and trip around the world. O ye generation of vipers, woe unto you who hear the word and heed it not. Some New York collector got word of her gospel quilts, and seeing them said he'd pay big money to preserve her primitive art. She wrote her messages sometimes all night into those warm pages to cover 1,000 sinners, and ruined her eyes, married to that work, growing rich, living poor, not even noticing her threadbare dresses and the bony body peeking through. Next is a poem by Carl Phillips. I did not know or did not retain very much information about Carl Phillips, though I do have his collection from the Devotions on my shelf. So I was just reading about him a bit on the Poetry Foundation website, and there's a paragraph here that I think summarizes some of his influence and also how he has been influenced. A classicist by training, Phillips often employs classical forms and makes allusions to classical literature, art, and music. While in his teens, he began to write poetry. "I was a nerdy kid," he told the Chronicle of Higher Education. "Maybe it has to do with creating your own world. For some people, it's easier to create a world that you can rely on, that travels with you." Phillips entered Harvard University on a scholarship and studied Latin and Greek. For a long time, he did not write any poetry, but in 1990, while coming to terms with his identity as a gay man, he rediscovered his poetic voice. Carl Phillips has several collections. This one, titled From the Devotions, is 1998, and I'll be reading a poem titled Luna Moth. "No eye that sees could fail to remark you. Like any leaf, the rain leaves fixed to and flat against the barn's gray shingle. But what leaf this time of year is so pale? The pale of leaves when they've lost just enough green to become the green that means loss and more loss approaching. Give up the flesh enough times, and whatever is lost gets forgotten. That was the thought that I woke to, those words in my head. I rose, I did not dress. I left no particular body sleeping, and stepping into the hour, I saw you, strange sign, at once transparent and impossible to entirely see through. And how still, the still of being unmoved, and then the still of no longer being able to be moved. If I think of a heart, his, as I found it, if I think of, increasingly, my own, if I look at you now, as from above, and see the diva when she is caught in mid-triumph, arms half-raised, the body as if set at last free of the green sheath that has, how many nights, held her. It is not without remembering another I once saw. Like you, except that something, a bird, some wild and necessary hunger, had gotten to it. And like the diva, but now broken, splayed and torn, the green torn piecemeal from her. I remember the hands and how small they seem, bringing the small ripped thing to me. The next poem is from a Yale Series of Younger Poets publication. Louise Gluck writes the foreword for Radial Symmetry by Katherine Larson. I think this is a very sort of science-y mind, Katherine Larson's. And if I were going to build a trio of poems from these that I've read so far, I think I would put this poem, Statuary, with Trophic Cascade, and then maybe something from Alice Oswald or Ted Kooser as kind of like a little STEM poetry series or something like that. I think Katherine Larson is a very keen observationalist. This is called Statuary. The late cranes throwing their necks to the wind stay somewhere between the place that rain begins and the place that it ends. They seem to exist just there above the horizon. At least I only see them that way, tossed up against the gray October light, not heavy enough for feet to be useful or useless enough to make gravity untie its string. I'm sick of this stubbornness, but the earthworms seem to think it all right. They move forward and let the world pass through them. They eat and eat at it, content to connect everything through the individual links of their purple bodies. To stay one place would be death. But somewhere between the crane and the worm, between the days I pass through and the days that pass through me, is the mind and memory, which outruns the body, and grief, which arrests it. Wow, that's a very interesting poem. I'll have to see if I could find it online so you could see the way it's printed in the page. There is very, very, very little punctuation in this poem. And even sometimes the enjambment doesn't help you very much knowing where to pause. So it becomes a bit of a challenge. It's almost like voicing the poem is another element to the thematic thrust of the poem itself. And I would not have realized that if I had not read it aloud for this episode. And finally, day 10 wasn't so much a poem, but I just read around a little bit in this collection from Tolkien. I have read some things and I've mentioned this on the podcast before because a few listeners have indicated that they have picked up the book because of my recommendation. It's called Letters from Father Christmas, and the premise of this book is that these are letters and also the artwork. So the illustrations in this book are just absolutely magical and engaging. The first of these letters came in 1920 when John, who is Tolkien's eldest son, was 3 years old. And for over 20 years, through the childhoods of Michael, Christopher, and Priscilla, these letters continued to arrive each Christmas. There would be envelopes dusted with snow, and he drew the polar postage stamps. And in addition to the letters, all of these beautiful drawings and illustrations, and the characters that he develops, like this polar, very, very accident-prone polar bear, keeps appearing and reappearing in the letters. Here's a letter from Cliff House, North Pole, Christmas, 1937. My dear Christopher and Priscilla and other old friends in Oxford, here we are again. Of course, I am always here when not traveling, but you know what I mean. Christmas again. I believe it is 17 years since I started to write to you. I wonder if you have still got all my letters. I have not been able to keep quite all of yours, but I have got some from every year. We had quite a fright this year. No letters came from you. Then one day in early December, I sent a messenger who used to go to Oxford a lot but had not been there for a long while, and he said, "Their house is empty and everything is sold." I was afraid something had happened or that you had all gone to school in some other town and your father and mother had moved. Of course, I know now the messenger had been to your old house next door. He complained that all the windows were shut and the chimneys all blocked up. I was very glad indeed to get Priscilla's first letter and your two nice letters and useful lists and hints since Christopher came back. I quite understood that school makes it difficult for you to write like you used, and of course I have new children coming on my list each year, so I don't get any less busy. Tell your father I am sorry about his eyes and throat. I once had my eyes very bad from snow blindness, which comes from looking at sunlit snow, but it got better. I hope Priscilla and your mother and everyone else will be well on December 25th. I am afraid I have not had any time to draw you a picture this year. You see, I strained my hand moving heavy boxes in the cellars in November and could not start my letters until later than usual, and my hand still gets tired so quickly. But Illibereth, one of the cleverest elves who I took on as a secretary not long ago, is becoming very good. He can write several alphabets now, Arctic, Latin, that is ordinary European, like you use, Greek, Russian, runes, and of course Elvish. His writing is a bit thin and slanting. He has a very slender hand, and his drawing is a bit scratchy, I think. He won't use paints, says he is a secretary and so only uses ink and pencil. He is going to finish this letter for me, as I have to do some others. So, I will now send you lots of love, and I do hope that I have chosen the best things out of your suggestion lists. I was hoping to send hobbits. I am sending away loads, mostly second editions, which I sent out for only a few days ago, but I thought you would have lots, so I am sending another Oxford fairy story. Lots and lots of love, Father Christmas.